Succession number 20375, Reel 3.
Bill Bailey, Reel 3.
I was looking into the guts of the thing, and this very pink, very young face peered over the turret and said, "Is this one troop?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Is this one brave?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I'm the radio operator that's taking over this tank." I was just coming up to 21 then, and I looked at this face, and he was a baby. He was, I don't think he'd started shaving. He had to be 18. But he was clean and fresh and young, and he still had the innocence in his eyes that I hadn't seen in a long, long time. And I invited him down to look at what was going on. And he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm just going to change two of the valves in the set to make sure that it's on top line." And he said, "Haven't we got any Royal Signals radio mechanics?" And I sort of had a half smile, because yes, we did, but you know, they usually stayed fairly well back in RHQ, and as a result, if you needed a radio repaired, you did it yourself, or if it was that bad, then you sent words down the line and they would bring you another radio, and you just took the old one out and put a new one in and retune it that way. But as I say, we used to rebuild the things from, we carried a case of 6 or 8 valves, and the K2 valve was the cow that always burnt out. I don't know why, whether I didn't know enough about radio then as to why that one valve, if your radio packed up, 99 times out of 100 you used to pull the thing out, take the K2 out, stick a new one in, and it would come back to life and you'd go back to square one. But the look on this, of horror on this kid's face, to think that he turned around and said, "I'm only a B3 and I thought, "Yeah, well, so am I."
A B3
is the bottom line radio operator. You start at B3, B2, B1, and they were various stages of your training, and B3 was the one that you passed in basic training. You were a B3. The Armoured Corps had a fabulous system. Every crew member was interchangeable in at least 2 trades. You were a gunner operator, you were a gunner driver, you were a driver operator. So that at any one time, anybody could swap. I mean, many of the time I sat in the gunner's seat. And we used to change ends. Drivers, for some reason, didn't like to get out of their driving seat and get up into the fighting compartment. But going back, when I look back and think how 3 men, again, the driver could drop his seat back, stretch out, and he could then sleep in his driving compartment. Because you've got to remember that for some periods of time, 3, 4 days, 5 days, we could be closed down, that's all the lids closed, and you'd sleep in there. And all you've got is a little, on the operator side, you've got a seat, because basically you're not meant to sit down in a tank when you're working, you're supposed to be standing up, because that's what your job was. And we discovered that you could live in a tank. It wasn't comfortable, but it was better than living in a hole. And I remember I'm lucky because I'm 5'4", which makes me short, which makes me an ideal tank man. I always remember a lad called Jock Bruce, who was a Scotsman and was 6'3". Now, how he managed to fit into a tank, I don't know. But I could lay on the recoil system of the tank, of the gun, and I could fit on there. I could roll my bedroll out, and I could sleep on. The gunner had to have a seat, a bucket seat, and he had to sit in that. But he could ease it back and get his legs stretched out. And the commander, again, he could drop his seat, but his feet usually ended up in the back of the neck of the gunner, because the gunner sat immediately forward and below the commander. And the result was, the reason was that the optical sights, the times 10 binoculars and the times 6 binoculars, the gunner had a times 6 binocular, which was the sights that he could see through, but the commander had a times 10. And they were synchronized so that if whatever the commander was looking at, that was what the gunner was looking at. And as a result, they had to be hand in glove next to each other. And I always remember where I was sitting there on one occasion, and my eyes aren't the best. And Bob turned around and said, "Can you see that small white building?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, you've got to." He said, I'm looking straight at it." And for the life of me, I could not see this little white building. And this is where a man who has been through World War II had the edge on somebody who has had no war experience. Because he turned around and he said, "Travis Wright, steady on." And you move the gun, and you've got a wheel in this hand and a wheel in that hand. This one, your left hand raises and lowers the muzzle. The right hand traverses left and right. So, Travis Wright means you're moving your gun to the right, steady on. Now, these are basic instructions that you were taught as a young recruit at the gunnery ranges at Walkup or wherever, Lulworth. When you got to that sort of stage, Bob would then turn around and say, "Hold it left a bit." I have never found an army manual that told me to traverse a gun left and right to do it a bit. But he would tell you to go left a bit, or right a bit, or up a bit, or down a bit, and you knew after a few weeks of working with a man, and I don't think it was just him, I think it was any tank commander that had done a long time in tanks, had worked out what that difference was between the digits on the each wheel had dials, and they had little brass pieces filed into them so that you went click, click, click. Now a click was so many degrees, but once you got used to holding the gun and it became part of you, he would say Travis left a bit. That was not one complete click. It wasn't this one and it wasn't that one. It was that spare bit between the two. And you could turn the gun and you could watch it and you'd say, yes, that's where he wants it. And the same with raising and lowering it. He'd say, Travis, elevate, lift it, steady, hold it there. Now, hold it there, just a bit. And you, again, your wrist would lock and you'd hold the gun and you would hold it there, and when he said fire, that shell was going to land where he wanted it. And he was a character who could... I never felt afraid. All the time he was with me, I think it was the fact that he'd been through World War II and he'd come out the other end and he was now with us. And I knew that he was fireproof. And he could... When you began to feel... not afraid, because I don't think that may be strange, but I didn't feel afraid the whole 15 months I was there. I don't think I was afraid in the sense that I was going to be killed. I don't think at any one time right the way through, even in the big battles like the Indian River Battle or the Ham or Kion Yang, or any of them, I don't think I was frightened in as much as I was frightened of being afraid, I think, if that makes sense. I didn't believe that anything could happen. Again, couldn't happen to me. It couldn't happen to me. When I heard that Tony Costello was killed, who was a buddy in another tank, it's almost as though you think, basically, why him? Because as I said, it's only the good ones, the good blokes that seem to get killed. And I'd only been speaking to him the day before. And I thought, well, why him? I think that the funny thing was, I always remember we had a little Midlands lad. And we'd come under a pretty bad attack that night. And stuff was coming down all around us. And he very seriously turned round and said, why are they shooting at us? We haven't done anything. And he meant that. It wasn't humour, it wasn't... He was very deadly serious. He could not understand why the Chinese were shooting back at him. Because he didn't know any Chinamen. And we sort of just sat there and looked at each other, and I think that's when war comes to you, and you think to yourself, what am I doing here? Why are we doing this? And it doesn't stay with you, that feeling. It doesn't stay very long, because you don't... You've got a job to do, basically. I think the best fighting man, infantry-wise, that I ever come across was the Royal Australian Rifles. They have a phlegmatic attitude to life that doesn't... I haven't met it anywhere else. I've met a lot of soldiers in my 25 years, different types of soldiers, different countries' soldiers, of Canadians, Australians, Americans, British. But for some reason, the Aussie has got this attitude that as soon as I've got this job done, I can go home. And I remember we were sitting on, I think it was 199, and they were our forward troops. And we'd got a radio message to say that there was, oh, this is classic, grenade-throwing monkeys have been seen on the hills opposite. And when it was finally deciphered, we discovered that the signals op that had passed the word couldn't spell the word gorilla. And it was gorillas that were chomping through the undergrowth and not monkeys. But this Aussie turned around and said, if we're going to start fighting bleeding apes, I'm going home. And we were sitting there, I'm sitting up on the tank, because we had a Visa 3.75mm cannon mounted on the turret, which was a secondary armament. And that was my gun. And there was another one down in the turret which was coaxially mounted to the big gun. You could use the sights on the tank in the driving compartment, in the fighting compartment. The gunner could use his x6 binoculars and use a machine gun. You didn't have to use a big gun, just by squeezing the trigger, flicking the switch and pulling the trigger, you could fire the machine gun, which give you a lot clearer sight, obviously, with the binoculars. But if you were in close, then you could use the big gun up on the top. And it switched later to an American Browning, which was a big gun. And I remember we were sitting there that night, on stand two, and, first light. I don't know why they ever called it first light, because it was always bloody dark. And we'd got the wire strung out further down the side of the hill, and we used to tie empty tins, ration tins, and we used to tie it on the wire. And that used to be a pretty good alarm. If you touched it, they used to rattle like hell, and you knew that at least something was down there. It could have been anything, but the odds were it was going to be a Chinaman. And I was doing my stint, and all of a sudden these tins rattled. and you get this sick feeling in the pit of your stomach. And suddenly this shadow came out of the dark. And it didn't look like a soldier, inasmuch as it didn't have a tin helmet and it didn't, and it was all hunched. And so, halt, who goes there? Nothing. Cock the gun. Halt, who goes there? Will you shut up, you pommy bastard? And it was one of the Royal Australian Rifles, a lad that I learned later was called Bomber Brown, Private Bomber Brown of the Royal Australian Rifles. He'd got his coat collar turned up, no tin helmet, no hat, his rifle slung on his back, and he was on guard. But he was mooching up and down this slit trench. And I said, are you on guard? And he said, yeah, and I'm pissed off. And I said, why? He said, because I'm half an hour overdue and I'm still here. And I said, well, is there anybody out there? He says, probably. He says, there's probably thousands, but they ain't going to come up tonight. So I said, why not? He said, because in about 10 minutes, it's going to piss down with rain. And I said, how do you know? He said, because I'm from the Northwest Territory of Australia, mate. And we don't get a lot of rain. He says, and I can smell rain long before the rain comes. And he says, and I am getting really peed off with this. And just then, there's a challenge further down. Yeah, I'm over here. And two more come along, a sergeant and one. Where are you in, Brown? He says, right here. He said, where am I going to go? So he said, you should have been somewhere else. And he said, this bloody hill all looks the same. He says, who's going to worry about which bit I'm standing on? And it was, I think it was that attitude that they didn't care. As far as he was concerned, one bit of dirt in Korea looked very much like another bit of dirt in Korea, and he was quite happy to fight on the bit he was on. And we became very good friends, in fact. We stayed with the Rifles for about 3 months. And they had a strange attitude to life. They could con some of the hardest nosed officers. They could, I always remember one of their sergeant majors coming and asking if he could borrow one of our tanks, because he'd got quite heavy stuff to carry up this hill, and he didn't want his men to sort of work themselves to death getting it up. So we run this tank down the hill, and we got barbed wire and rolls and whatnot slung on the back of Centurion, and we trundled it up the hill and back down and trundled it back up the hill. And it was only at the end of the day, and we were watching them unload, that they also had quite a number of cases of acai beer stuck on the bottom. The first layer was beer, and then their combat equipment was on top. And they stood there straight-faced without batting an eyelid and swore blind that beer was part of their combat rations and therefore they needed it, otherwise it was just a waste of time bringing the rest of the stuff up. And they believed it. They really, really believed that. And that was an amazing thing. When we first met the American First Cavalry, we didn't really have a lot to do with the Americans as such, on an individual basis. In the line, you didn't see them. You heard that the American 1st Cavalry and whoever, the 101st and 102nd Division, were over on your left, and so-and-so was over on your right, and you had either the Northumberland Fusiliers or the Gloucesters or whoever to the front. They were ours. They were our foot soldiers. But we pulled out of the line and we changed over with some Americans, and we were going back for a rest. And when I say we pulled out, we were, the battle was still there, and I suppose we were re-kitting, I think. We were rearming and whatnot. And winter was coming. Winter in Korea was strange. You could have a beautiful autumn day when you went to bed, and you could wake up the next morning with 2 foot of snow, and suddenly winter had arrived, and that, it was cold. It was, I don't know where that cold came from, but it was colder than anything I'd ever felt in my life before, because initially we weren't ready, and we sent back for supplies of winter clothing. And for that first few weeks of the winter, that first winter, we were given a Korean heavy wool pullover in addition to our long johns and the normal thin pullover that the squaddy was issued with. And then we got a tank suit, which helped. And I can't remember where we were coming from, but we were pulling out from somewhere on one of the occasions when Korea was a funny war, in as much as we seemed to spend more time running backwards and forwards than actually staying in any one place for any length of time. And we were coming back through Kaesong? Probably Kaesong. And all hell was breaking loose with the Americans. They were piling into every sort of conceivable vehicle that they could, and everything was going up in smoke, and it was a supply depot. So the English squaddy, being what he was, immediately thought there's got to be something we can nick, borrow or whatever. So we went over and said, what's going on? And said, we're bugging out. And well, we knew that because we were in the same position. We were withdrawing. And we said, well, what's all that happening to all this? And they said, well, we're burning it. And the first thing I asked, is there any cigarettes? I think that one over there. And they were huge marquees. And they were filled with clothing, rations, cigarettes, goodies, basically is what we used to call them. And we grabbed two cartons of, it said, anoraks. I'd never heard them.